Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We begin the show today by talking about mining in Wisconsin. You'll hear about the history of mining in our state and also about what's going on today. Our guests, a couple of guests, Molly Gardner is the Wisconsin DNR's Metallic Mining Coordinator, and with us as well. And Molly, by the way, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining in.
Hi, Larry. Happy to be here.
With us as well, Tracy Lee Roberts, Senior Lecturer Emeritus from the Department of History at UW-Platteville. And Tracy, welcome to you.
Thanks, Larry. Good to talk with you.
Great to have you with us. As we talk with our two guests today, I hope you'll join in. What do you think mining meant for early Wisconsinites? What questions do you have about the state's history of lead mining, perhaps? What are you wondering about metallic mining in Wisconsin today? Number to call, 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@wpr.org. Molly, before we go back in time, maybe talk about mining history. Tell us about the different types of mining we have in Wisconsin. There are maybe three different types at least?
Sure. The Wisconsin DNR categorizes mining generally into two categories, metallic and non-metallic. And within the metallic subset, there are two types. So it does equal three. But under metallic, there's ferrous, which is mining for iron ores. And then there's non-ferrous, which is all other types of metal mining, gold, copper, silver, nickel, lead, zinc, et cetera. And then the non-metallic piece is mining for materials such as sand, gravel, stone, clay, typically from pits or quarries, and not from large-scale mines. And non-metallic is the only type of active mining in Wisconsin.
How'd they get here? How do those metals arrive in Wisconsin?
Is that a history question?
I'm thinking geology and so forth. I'm wondering about that.
Sure. There are mine deposits around the state, in northern Wisconsin, in the Gogebic and Florence districts, and then over on the east central side in the Black River Falls area in Jackson County. And then across the central part of the state, there is a volcanic massive sulfide or VMS deposit that was formed through volcanic activity where metal-rich fluid down on the ocean floor escaped through fractures, came out through hydrothermal vents, and then once they hit that cold seawater, created these massive sulfide mounds on the seafloor, which are rich in minerals. And that area is known for, across central Wisconsin, is known for copper, zinc, gold, and silver.
Yeah. Well, the Driftless region, lead. Why was lead found in the southern section of this region?
Well, you know, Larry, the ground around here is karst topography, so that means it has a lot of fissures in it. It's mostly limestone, of course. And like your other guest said, the briny waters were bringing up, you know, microscopic molecules on steam and bringing it toward, you know, the Earth's surface. And so it got over millions of years put into these sort of crevices and cracks that are around this region. So driftless means there's no glacial drift here. That means that the area, let's say, from about Winona, Minnesota, down through Joe Davis County, Illinois, is driftless. In other words, glaciers did not flatten this area. We don't have hundreds of feet or 100 to 300 feet of glacial drift on top of, you know, the bedrock.
Sure.
So it's easier to find the lead here. It's in the fissures. It's in the cracks. And when Native Americans first noticed that there was lead and found ways that they wanted to use that lead, you know, it was lying on the ground, basically. It was in caves. It was, you know, pretty easy to get.
And how did they use it?
Well, Native Americans in the earliest times in our prehistoric period, we know, for example, there are lead chunks in Hopewell sites in Ohio. So that was Galena, from the Galena, Illinois area. In other words, the area where we have the mining in southern Wisconsin through Galena, Illinois area. So they were using these possibly as symbolic or a spiritual uses because we find them in the grave sites, which is usually considered a spiritual space. Also, they would grind lead, which often had little flecks of silver in it. So it'd be very shiny, beside that lead has that kind of luster. And it would be ground into sort of a powder, and then you could add fat to it to make it into a body paint.
Oh.
So they were using it that way in the very earliest days. But, of course, as soon as the French came along and were interested in lead to make bullets and make, you know, all kinds of products that we know are, you know, that lead is used for, then, of course, it becomes an international commodity that different imperial nations want to get a hold of from the 1600s, you know, until the Americans take over the region.
It was kind of big business at that time, wasn't it? Or it became big business a bit?
Absolutely. It's what put all these towns on the map. I'm in Platteville, Wisconsin, and Platteville is here because of the lead. Galena, Illinois. Galena, the Latin word for lead sulfide, is there because of the lead ore. Dubuque, Iowa, is there because of the lead ore. So, yes, this whole region that we have in the southern driftless region of southwest Wisconsin, northern Illinois, and over into Dubuque, Iowa, is just pockmarked with mines. You can still see them today in the backwoods, you know.
You mentioned Dubuque. Tell us about Julian Dubuque and the Fever River mining camp.
Yeah, he was a really interesting character. So he was a French-Canadian. And, of course, the French had already discovered that there were lead mines very early on. We had the Marquette and Joliet, various traversing the river, trying to find out what kinds of commodities were here, what kind of people were here. And so the French already were marking, you know, mine de plume, which in French is lead mines, and they'd have that on their maps. So, you know, Julian Dubuque certainly knew there were lead mines in this area. And by that time, the Meskaki Indians, or we used to call them the Fox, were inhabiting the area with Sauk, Ho-Chunk, Menominee, and some other groups. And they were mining the ore in that more small way. But once Dubuque came along, he was doing fur trading, lead mining, and farming on a piece of land that the Meskaki leased to him in the late 1700s. So he made a big production out of it, and there was a big Creole culture, so that'd be Native American and French people, kind of a community of people mining and fur trading and farming for him. That lasted till 1810 when Julian Dubuque died, but he really got the whole thing started in this area in a big way. So this lead ore would be shipped down river, you know, it's right there at the Mississippi. Dubuque's right on that bluff. So that's how Julian Dubuque kind of got the lead mining going in a bigger way.
So he signed a contract with the Native Americans over some of the land, but I'm wondering what kind of reaction overall did Native Americans have to white settlers on their land and in their mines?
Well, you know, when Dubuque was there, he was creating community. He is purported to have married a Meskaki woman named Josette. She's listed in his estate. There's an estate piece that talks about all the different buildings and the things, and she's mentioned as Madame Dubuque on this document in 1811. So, you know, at first it seemed like it was going pretty well, but after a while, it's not just sharing the land and leasing the land. It becomes we need to own the land. So as Americans came from the South and from the East, and later lots of ethnic groups from Europe, who came to mine lead in our region, you know, they started wanting to own the land, and the American government wanted to own the land. They believed they did own the land. So there were treaties made that were considered fraudulent, like the 1804 treaty that took over all the lead mine district from Native American groups. And it is considered fraudulent because the Native Americans who signed it were not actually the leaders of their groups. So there was a lot of contested and angry moments in this history. Native Americans, the Meskaki and Sauk and Ho-Chunk, they kept white Americans off of their land by using violence. They told them, get up, get out. They sequestered them to the islands in the Mississippi River. So if you want to trade with us, you're going to have to stay on the island, and we'll come to you with some lead in our boat, and then you can take it and do what you want with it. But they were not going to let them see the lead mines.
Yeah, but that changed.
It did.
I'm wondering, what was the day-to-day life of a miner in Wisconsin like?
Well, it was pretty rough, I can tell you that. Certainly we had some trails and really rough and rude roads. People described the area as scrappy, and it was very, very male-dominated, of course. It was at least a 2-to-1 ratio. In the earliest days, 3-to-1 ratio of men to women. So a lot of young single men were in the lead mines. And when visitors came into the area in the mid-20s and early 1830s, they discussed how scrappy it was and how irreligious it was and, you know, how willy-nilly it was. So the basic daily life of the miner would be, at first, they were only going to mine in the warmer months. And then, for example, southern miners from Tennessee, southern Illinois, Missouri, they'd just go home again, you know. They'd go home in the winter where it's warmer. They were called suckers because, like the sucker fish, they'd go up north in warm weather and return in cooler weather, right? Mm-hmm. So they all had nicknames. All these different groups had nicknames, and, you know, they scrapped with each other. But basically, miners had to have a pick and a gad. So you've got a couple tools. A gad is like a chisel or, a crowbar-type tool, and then you've got a pick. And you dig a hole, and you look for a seam of lead. And you're going to be able to see it pretty easily. And then you follow that seam, and you try to extract that ore. And that would be with a windlass over the hole in the ground and a bucket. So, you know, pretty simple, actually.
Yeah.
And then in the evening, they'd go to the pub, and they'd drink and sing songs and play cards.
Yeah. At its peak, what did Wisconsin's role in the lead industry mean for our economy?
It meant a lot because lead mining in the area of northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin was the biggest modern, if you will, industrial endeavor in the whole area, in the whole northern United States. So it was big. When you have miners coming in, well, then you need people to service the miners with their tools and their clothing. So more people come in, and pretty soon you've got bankers, and you've got grocery stores, and you've got people selling things and offering lawyer services, you know. So it becomes where all these little mining camps become small villages, towns, and cities. So it's a huge, huge impact between 1825 and 1865. Then the whole area, as lead becomes more difficult to get to because it's below the water table and there isn't an efficient, cheap enough way to extract that lead ore. Pretty soon, you know, farming becomes the main occupation of people in this region.
And we see a transition, or I should say, when did we see a transition to zinc mining? Because that came in sort of after lead mining, I think.
Yeah, it sure did, because zinc, they really didn't have a processing. They didn't have the processing. Zinc is more difficult to process than lead. Also, it's usually deeper down. So these shallow pit mines were not extracting zinc, and they didn't have as much use for it in the very earliest days. So as they went through their scrap pits of piles of mining debris from the mining industry, they realized that there was zinc there as zinc became better known as an important metal. So they would go through and reprocess these scrap, these piles of, piles of old smelted ore and different things. And they'd go through the old rock and they'd find lots and lots of zinc. So then they started processing zinc, which is a much more industrial process. Required a lot more equipment and modern know-how. We have places in our area, if anyone's interested. Like, you can go to Mineral Point, mm-hmm. and you can climb the Merry Christmas Mine Hill. And at Mineral Point, it's across from the Pendarvis site that's owned by the Wisconsin Historical Society. And it will kind of give you some illustration of what the lead mining looked like and then what the zinc mining looked like, because both of those occurred on that lead hill.
Hmm. What was the ecological effect of lead mining?
The mining itself, you know, brought up lots of heavy metals and things that you don't want to have in your water supply. So that was one problem. So you're going into the earth and you're bringing up things that we don't want humans and animals to encounter. The other problem was the smelting process. So when you have lead sulfide, you have to subject it to about 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit mm-hmm. in a blast furnace. And this sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide, the molecules are released then from the ore, and that reacts to the oxygen and the water vapors in the atmosphere, and that causes sulfuric acid, which is acid rain. And that causes, like, soil acidity, and that harms plants and animals. It makes the air toxic. So, you know, some of the descriptions of the area of southern Wisconsin where people came through, they said it just was barren and it looked awful. You know, that it was ugly. There were no trees. All the trees have been taken down for the lead smelters. And the land was, you know, kind of scoured with acid rain effects. So, yeah, it was very harmful.
Talking today with Molly Gardner, the Wisconsin DNR Metal Mining Coordinator, and we've been hearing from Tracy Lee Roberts on the history of mining in our state. Tracy's a senior lecturer emeritus from the Department of History at UW-Platteville. Questions for our guests? Give us a call, the number 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. At noon today, we'll hear why scientists are cautiously optimistic about the ruffed grouse population in our state, and then we'll take a look at new information about glyphosate or Roundup and what that means for you and for me. Right now, we're looking at the history and we're getting into the present day of mining with our two guests, Tracy Lee Roberts, Senior Lecturer Emeritus from the Department of History at UW-Platteville, and Molly Gardner, Wisconsin DNR's Metal Mining Coordinator. And you can join in, too, number 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. Michael emailed us with the greater number of men around lead mines, did it bring on prostitution?
That's a really good question. I've read a lot of the court records from the earliest days, and I have seen prostitution maybe once or twice, but not much. There are lots of other cases, though, like rape cases, that came to court. So I'm talking about Lafayette County mostly. I've seen a bunch of those records from the earliest lead mining days. So I don't think there was a lot of prostitution here, but I'm sure that the oldest profession was engaged in here. Yes.
Okay. Let's turn to Molly Gardner. Molly, do we have metallic mines operating in Wisconsin currently?
No, we do not. The last metallic mine, the only metallic mine that was permitted, constructed, or reclaimed in Wisconsin since the mining laws were adopted in the late 1970s, was the Flambeau Mine in the town of Ladysmith in Rusk County. The Flambeau Mine operated for 4 years from 1993 to 1997, and it has since been reclaimed and is under long-term monitoring and bonding so that we can ensure a successful reclamation.
And what are the DNR's responsibilities when it comes to regulating mining activities?
So the DNR is the lead regulatory agency for metallic mining in Wisconsin. We consult with other agencies on particular projects if needed, but we will issue the mining permit if it gets to that point.
We'll take some calls. Richard in Rockdale will go to you. Richard, thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you, Larry. I have, an interesting side effect, secondary effect on immigration because of lead mining. I did some research on lead mining as a science writer at a university many years ago. And the lead to get to the Great Lakes for shipping had to go down through Illinois to Chicago, which was a long journey, and an even worse journey was to go from the lead mines to Green Bay and down to Milwaukee. But in 1838 or 1839, a trail was cut from Milwaukee somewhat directly to the lead mines. And that trail went right along the edge of what is now Rockdale, under another name at that time. And when the Norwegians, a small handful of Norwegians discovered Koshkonong Prairie, the area between Madison and Rockdale, generally speaking, they wrote letters home, and their immigrant friends simply had a three-day walk from Milwaukee to Koshkonong Prairie. And they got to what is now Rockdale and spread out over the prairie. And Rockdale is a bustling social and economic center. And all the Norwegians, most of them, came through that route and then spread out to Mount Horeb area and Iowa County and Iola and all kinds of places. But they came right through there with a three-day walk off the ship. But I want to tell you something, a really fun story. When I was doing this research, I was looking into lead mining, and in 1832, for the process of converting lead to shot for cannons and rifles and stuff, and I came upon an anecdote published in the local paper in 1832. There was a certain miner who was quite a character, giving people a hard time and having a lot of fun. And another fellow took offense at that and challenged him to a duel. The challenger was named the date and the day and time, tomorrow at sunrise, and the challenge could pick the actual place and type of weapon. So they all showed up in the morning, and there's a big crowd to see this duel, and the challenged individual, the character, was standing by a lead mine, a pit, and he said, okay, here's where I will stand, and we'll have a duel at 40 feet, and you'll be down at the bottom of the pit. So everyone had a good laugh at that, and that was the end of it.
Well, that's quite a story. Tracy Lee Roberts, comments?
Well, I'm not surprised to hear that. The lead mine district brought in a lot of fierce people, I'd say, people who were not necessarily against breaking the law a bit, including Henry Dodge, our first territorial governor, who brought in enslaved people illegally, as did, you know, we had, you know, Billy Hamilton here, the son of Alexander Hamilton was in our region in Wisconsin. You know, originally in Galena, Illinois, the Johnson brothers, including Richard M. Johnson, who became the vice president of the United States, was here. And he was the first one to bring in the federal government troops to secure the mines away from the Indians in 1822 area, that time period. So I'm not surprised to hear stories about duels and things like that. This kind of thing did happen here, even though it was illegal in the United States, generally speaking.
Jolene emailed us with a question for Tracy. Is there a state or county park you could visit to see a lead mine vein in the state, possibly some of the equipment as well?
We have the museum. So I mentioned the Mineral Point Mine Hill, which is called the Merry Christmas Mine Hill. Yeah. And you can kind of see the equipment there for zinc mining. And then you'll see just a number of, is this a good time of year to go? You can see a number of those early pit mines that the lead miners were exploring from the 1826 to, you know, 45 period. So I would recommend that. Then we have some museums. So the Mining and Rollo Jameson Museum in Platteville, That describes mining very well, and you can go down in the mine. But they're not open again until May because the mine is usually pretty wet this time of year as things are melting and, you know, it seeps through. But there is a mine there. The Badger Mine in Schulzburg, that will be, I think they're going to be closed this summer, but they're going to be remodeling and rebuilding. But they have a wonderful early lead mine there that you can learn a lot from. So yeah, we have a whole lot of opportunities. I would just Google, you know, those opportunities, and you'll be able to find them all.
I'm thinking back when I was in eighth grade, we had an eighth grade class trip, and part of the trip we went to visit Shot Tower Hill.
Yes. Which, that's a great place, and that teaches you how shot was made, and that's near Spring Green, so that's on the southern side of the Wisconsin River, and you can go down there and get up into that shot tower and take a look at how that worked.
It was pretty pretty cool. I still actually remember that trip. It was pretty interesting. Well, Jolene emailed us with a question for Tracy. Is there a state or, I fouled up there, and I had already asked that question. So let's turn to Jim in Middleton. Emailed us with a question for Molly. What is the likelihood of undiscovered metallic ores in Wisconsin?
That's hard to say. Across the VMS deposit in central Wisconsin, there's been active exploration looking at the extents of the known deposits. And I've heard talk about gravity surveys being flown in the areas of where the deposits outcrop. So it's possible that there could be an anomaly in that VMS region that results in a new deposit being discovered.
Eric in Oneida County, we'll go to you next. Eric, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Larry, thank you for taking my call. What's on my mind? Northern and north central Wisconsin, a hotbed of potential metallic sulfide mining, and the public's opinion against mining in the North Woods and the like. Yes, there is a current drilling process going on in Taylor County and multiple potential mines across north central Wisconsin, Oneida County, Marathon County, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the main concern I have is that, you know, politicians have made laws that don't necessarily reflect the public's opinion on mining, particularly in their town or their county. And there's a great concern when a potential mine comes, local input will be nil, and from Madison or from legislation will drive that industry back into Wisconsin when it's a boom or bust industry. Most people don't want the pollution or the mess that comes along with it. So I hate to take you off the romanticized part of mining, but the real mining today is ugly. It always pollutes, which is why our politicians repealed our Prove It First law, which gave protection to make them prove that they could do it cleanly. And now we're in the situation we're at.
Well, let's go to Molly for a comment, Molly.
Sure. I can say that right now the explorers are just doing exploration drilling right now. There are no mines on the horizon or in any sort of pre-application stage. That's a multi-year process to get to the pre-application stage from where the exploration is at. So at this point, there is no mining on the table. It's just looking at the deposits and trying to define the extent to see if it's feasible for a future project.
What are the can you kind of give us the whole process that they would have to go through?
So for exploration drilling, which is currently being pursued, let's see. It starts out with an exploration license is acquired, and then they proceed with providing an exploration plan. The DNR reviews the plan, and they obtain any other permits and approvals needed from the DNR or any other agencies, and then they can proceed with an exploration drilling campaign. If the exploration drilling proceeds and they decide it's deemed feasible to proceed with a mining application, it's a multi-step, multi-phase approach. I can go into it a little bit if you'd like. First, there's a pre-application and a start of baseline and data collection and site monitoring. It lasts a minimum of 12 months. The applicant submits preliminary project description, scope of study, et cetera. The DNR evaluates everything from the design to the waste characterization to the groundwater modeling. There's a public comment period throughout that time period. The DNR will then inform the applicant of what needs to be included data-wise for the permit application, and then any other permits they identified early, and then the applicant starts an environmental impact report. The next phase, there's a mining permit application. This includes the mining plan, a reclamation plan, a monitoring plan, waste site feasibility report, contingency plan, pre-blasting survey, and the application at that point will provide an environmental impact report for the DNR to review. Then the last phase, the DNR reviews all the application materials. The DNR then drafts an environmental impact statement. There's a public hearing and comment period. The DNR finalizes that environmental impact statement. And then if that whole application is in compliance with the Wisconsin Environmental Policy Act, then a mining permit is issued. So that's kind of the step generalized as a multi-year process to get into operations of a mine.
Yeah. John in Madison, what's on your mind?
Now, we hear a lot of talk in the news today about how the United States is pursuing mining rights for rare earth minerals in other countries. I was wondering, what are some of these rare earth minerals that are so much in demand today?
Back to you, Molly.
I'm not quite sure. There's a critical minerals list that copper just recently got added to that's put out by the USGS. And copper is a metal that's prevalent in Wisconsin. So that prioritizes exploration in Wisconsin a little bit more than prior to the adding copper to the list. But as to the rare earth elements, I'm not quite sure what effect that would have in Wisconsin.
John, thank you. Nancy in Wausau, we'll go to you next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi there. So glad to be able to speak with you today. And I'm going to piggyback off one of your other callers, Eric, that had called in. And, history, he couldn't have said it better. History tells us that, across the globe, that mining has, the story of it has been pretty short. It's boom and bust, short-lived. And, when we repealed the Proven First Law, which was at that time, he was the assemblyman, Tom Tiffany. He's now our congressperson. It really opened some floodgates there. And recently, I was at a preview given by Green Light Metals about the Bend discovery in Taylor County. And I had talked with board member Steve Donahue there. And I asked him, why was that repealed? Why did some of the mining companies actually help to rewrite that law? And his answer to me was because it wasn't good for business. And we know that, sulfide mines produce acid mine drainage. And this day and age, we're not just digging. It's 90-some% of the rock that is brought up is waste rock. And that's where this acid mine drainage comes in. And I guess, I would ask you, do we really want to see Wisconsin's farmlands and their lakes and streams, at such a risk for this? And whereas copper, for one, we could recycle. Are we not doing this just because there's not the money in it? And I think we need to kind of remind ourselves of Mark Twain's line of, a mine is nothing but a hole in the ground with a liar standing over it.
Nancy, thank you very much for calling. Molly, comments on any parts of Nancy's statement?
As a DNR employee, we regulate to state statute and code. So that's where our authority lies.
And so the political side of things is where the laws get made.
Yes.
And so you... I'm sorry, go ahead.
So get out and vote.
Jordan and Marengo will go to you next. Hi, Jordan.
Hi there. I'm real happy to hear some other like-minded comments. From, watching the industry for decades, I'm fairly aware of a lot of things, but mostly my father was a mega executive for a mining supply industry based out of Green Bay. And he got to travel all over Chile, America, Mexico. And he's a very pro-business, old-school Republican, very pro-development. And he told me that this should not be done in areas with, as he called it, groundwater issues, because the damage will be permanent. There will need to be water reclamation and remediation in perpetuity. And there is no technology that can abbreviate that. It's a simple ionic reaction. It's just chemistry. It's physics. And you can't get around it. And the thing is, now I heard on WPR some time ago, a representative from Wisconsin Manufacture and Commerce saying, we're safe in Wisconsin because we have very strong laws. But it's very important to point out that WMC is also lobbying to weaken those laws. And finally, I'd like to leave you with, I don't find it really reassuring when I hear that it's okay because they're just exploring now. It's not permitted yet. They're just exploring. It's not reassuring at all because it's not for no reason. So anyway, thanks for letting me participate, and I'll listen on the air. Thanks for your show.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Jordan. Molly, a comment?
Yeah, exploration has been ongoing for a century. Lots of sites get explored and don't proceed on to a mining application. So we see exploration every few years in the States, and we haven't had a mine since 1997. So it's up in the air as to what will happen.
Yeah. Our guests today, Tracy Lee Roberts, Senior Lecturer Emeritus from the Department of History at UW-Platteville, and Molly Gardner, Wisconsin DNR's Metallic Mining Coordinator, our guests. Questions for them, either of them, give a call, the number 800-642-1234, or you could email the email address talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about real estate law, and then you'll get some advice on estate planning. But right now, we're looking at mining in our state with Tracy Lee Roberts, Senior Lecturer Emeritus from the Department of History at UW-Platteville, and Molly Gardner, Wisconsin DNR's Metallic Mining Coordinator. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@WPR.org. Peter in Madison emailed wondering, are there current negative ecological remnants in the lead mining region of Wisconsin? And I'm not sure.
Hi. Yeah, this is Tracy. Yeah. I'll answer that if you mind.
Yeah,
if
go
you
ahead.
Want me to.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I'm quite aware of that there's still a lot of lead sludge in all of our rivers. Lead is very heavy, and it stays in the environment. It doesn't disappear. So this is very, very bad for the water quality. We are lucky that most of our towns, our cities like Platteville, where I am, we test the water and there's not appreciable amounts of lead. But we know that that sludge is sitting in the Mississippi River. We know that there are sites all over Wisconsin and into northern Illinois that are still packed with big remnants of the mining industry where you've got those heavy metals that haven't been secured. There was a Superfund site in Galena, Illinois that took, you know, years and years and years to remediate. It still looks sort of like Mordor out there where that zinc mining was. So, yeah, there's still a lot on the landscape that you can see with your own eyes, and you can also read reports about the constant monitoring for lead in the environment here.
The someone else is wondering, the law that was repealed in 2017 relating to the mining moratorium, it repealed the state's decades-old mining moratorium. Molly, can you explain what that was? And you probably don't know other than politics why it was repealed.
I know that it, what was repealed was the prove it first portion, where a mining interest would have to find an example of a successful mine that had no environmental ramifications in order to proceed with their permit application. And they found it was difficult to find examples of mines that had similar conditions. Some examples of successful mines were up in northern Canada in the tundra, which does not have the same water quality factors as a mine in Wisconsin. And then there was a mine that was examined in Nevada, also with a really deep water table. So that portion of it was removed. And I can't speak to the policy for why it was, but from a science perspective, it was hard to find mines that were of a similar nature that would be useful in our analysis of their permit application.
Yeah, and closed for, I think it was for 10 years, wasn't it?
Yeah, yep.
Without causing environmental harm. So that explains that part of it. I've got an email that goes back to history here, and so we'll deal with that right now. Steve called, couldn't stay with us. And Tracy, can you please explain what a shot tower is? We talked about one earlier.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay. So you're going to take you're going to process the lead in a lead smelter, which requires about 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit to drive those sulfur molecules off and to make the lead more pure, which makes it more malleable and, you know, easier to work with. Then you take that finished lead, and you're going to remelt it at maybe like 600 and some degrees. And you're going to build this big tower over a cool pool of water. So the shot tower that we were talking about at Tower Hill near Spring Green, that is right over the Wisconsin River. And so there was a basin there. So you take that molten lead, you're way up in the tower above the river, above the water, that the cool water at the bottom, and you're going to take this remelted lead, and it's going to be quite, you know, you're going to put it through a grate. So there's a grate that says how large that shot's going to become. Put it through the grate, and through centrifugal force, right, the lead's going to just keep swirling into a ball as it hits, you know, many feet down. I don't know if it's a 50 feet, 100 feet. Actually, I don't know how tall that tower is. But it'll hit into the pool of water as a round sphere, and it will be your shot. And it'll be different sizes depending upon what grate it goes through. I hope that explains it well enough.
Yeah, I think you did a pretty good job there. Centrifugal force works. Well, someone else is wondering, what are the potential environmental impacts of exploratory drilling? And then a follow-up, what are the strategies the DNR and its partners use to mitigate these impacts? And for that, of course, we'll turn to Molly Gardner from the DNR.
Sure. The DNR collaborates amongst the DNR departments on exploration applications and potential impacts. They review for things, cultural resources, endangered resources, permits for discharge of wastewater, stormwater management, construction and operation. There's a lot of different environmental aspects to the project, and different departments will come in and issue permits for those types of activities. And those are all taken care of before exploration can commence.
And what typically, what size or area of land is used in an operation like this?
Sure. It depends. It depends on the size of the project. A drill pad can be 50 feet by 50 feet and an associated access road to get out there. So for the current project that's being proposed, 15 drill sites, and the access routes are less than 3 acres of disturbance, ground disturbance.
And another email, the Canadian, the mining company, Canadian mining company, Greenlight Metals, is planning to expand exploration drilling in northern Wisconsin. One of those areas is the Bend deposit in Taylor counties. Wondering what metals are they looking for?
That will be a question for the company. They have a website you can refer to. We don't regulate what types of minerals they're looking for.
Yeah. What other agencies might you collaborate with during mining projects?
Lots of different DNR agencies, but local zoning has approvals, and it depends on the property owners, or sometimes the federal government gets involved on federal land or federal mineral estates. So all projects are a little bit different. There's typically it's DNR and the local zoning, and then anyone else that's required.
And do you see, let's put it, what's in store for the future of mining in Wisconsin? Let me put it that way. Do you think there will be more exploration drilling in the years to come, more or less regulations?
I don't know if the regulations will change, but for exploration drilling, I could see continued efforts. None of the efforts in the past have led to a mine since Flambeau, so it's hard to say. But there is one company that has some interest, so we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, see where that goes. And the main concern, center around water and the quality of water in the state. And if you're thinking about it from that perspective, what can we do to make sure that our water stays as good as it is now or better?
Sure. There's different parts of the review process. For exploration drilling, I guess, is because that's what we're focused on right now. During the exploration plan portion, they talk about how they're going to protect the resources. And then if there are any impacts, or if they're projecting any impacts to water quality or wetlands or waterways, then they will pursue permits, state permits, to mitigate for any of those impacts.
And one final question for Tracy. Where do you find out more information about the history of the mining in Wisconsin?
Well, don't mean to give my own plug, but I'll just throw it out there. I have a Facebook group called the Lead-Zinc Mining District of the Upper Mississippi River Valley. It's a long name, the Lead-Zinc Mining District of the Upper Mississippi River Valley. And a whole bunch of historians, geologists, past miners, they all chime in with different photographs and information about the lead mine district in this in our region here in southwest Wisconsin. So it's kind of an interesting group of people. There are many books on this topic that you could refer to. I would suggest going to these museums. They really do teach you so much.
Well, I want to thank you both. Tracy Roberts, Senior Lecturer from the Department of History at UW-Platteville. Molly Gardner, the Wisconsin DNR's Metallic Mining Coordinator. Thanks to them. Coming up, we're going to take a look at sharp-tailed grouse in Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're turning our attention to sharp-tailed grouse in Wisconsin with our guest, Bob Hansen. He's a wildlife biologist at the Wisconsin DNR. Bob spent the last 12 years as the Northwest Sands wildlife biologist working on sharp-tailed grouse barrens habitat projects. And for 11 years before that, Bob was a wildlife technician implementing barrens and sharp-tailed grouse work at Crex Meadows Wildlife Area. So as we talk with Bob, I hope you'll join in. What would you like to know about sharp-tailed grouse? Let us know how you've been involved in maybe in conservation efforts. When's the last time you saw a sharp-tailed grouse? Give us a call. The number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or email us to talk@wpr.org. Bob Hansen, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining in today. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having us.
How many species of grouse do we have in Wisconsin? I think it's four, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, we have obviously sharp-tailed grouse like we're talking about today. We have ruffed grouse. There's a few spruce grouse. And I don't think
prairie
I'm
chicken.
One.
I don't know. Maybe what about greater prairie chicken? Are they?
Oh, prairie chickens. Yeah, I guess they're considered a prairie grouse. So we can call them that. Yeah.
And what makes the sharp-tailed grouse so important for us here in the state?
Well, it's really a different type of species for Wisconsin. It once was really numerous across the state, mostly through the southern two-thirds or so, then in the northwest part of the state, long ago. And then over time, as we've gone more to agriculture systems in some places, and in the northwest part of the state, as the forests have grown up into bigger forests, sharp-tailed grouse is kind of more of a brushland species. They kind of need that prairie brushland mix. And as we've lost those types of habitats into more forested habitats, sharptails have reduced greatly because of that. But really, sharptails are a nice indicator species of a healthy barrens ecosystem up here in the Northwest. We know if we have kind of sharptail grouse, it's kind of an umbrella species, really, that if we have a healthy sharptail grouse population, we're going to have many, many other species as well. It's an area sensitive, which means it needs a great big open country to survive. So if we have a good enough habitat and enough quality and quantity of habitat for other species, we'll be there as well.
And there's maybe it'd be worth it to describe, because I think when people think about grouse, rough grouse probably comes to mind first. But what maybe the differences between the sharptail and the rough grouse?
Yeah, rough grouse, the rough grouse like that thicker kind of habitat, a mixture of age classes, definitely usually associated with aspen and those kind of young forest type systems, versus sharptails are more of that open country, wide open, where you can see a mile in many places. And they're also called the firebird. A lot of our management relies on prescribed burning, and they'll move in right after a prescribed burn in that really open type country and really thrive there. Sharptails are a little bit bigger than rough grouse, not a lot, and instead of kind of having a fanned out tail, they have these two kind of main pinnate feathers that are kind of make that sharp tail look to the appearance.
Yeah.
And rough grouse will drum in the spring, make that thump, 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 thump kind of noise, whereas the sharptails have lots of different calls, chuckles, and clucks, and I've always told people they sound a little bit like Martians when they're calling in the spring.
And of course, the sharptails are well known for their dancing during the courting season. Tell us more about that dancing and where it takes place.
Yeah, typically in a kind of an open spot, usually on a little bit of a rise with kind of an amphitheater effect around them, where the males can kind of show up and kind of jockey for position within the lek spot there. That's what we call the dancing ground is the lek, and try to kind of show off for the females and attract a female to mate with. The males will typically kind of bow down and bring their wings out a little bit and really stomp their feet really, really fast and kind of make kind of a rattling sound with their tails. And then they'll jump and they'll fight and they'll really kind of strut their stuff for this mating ritual that happens every spring.
Yeah, it's really, really cool to see. And there are chances for people to see that ritual.
Yeah, we have viewing blinds on Crex Meadows Wildlife Area, Damakagans Wildlife Area, and also on Douglas County Wildlife Area. those reservations for those viewing blinds are run through our friends groups from those various three wildlife areas. And I'll warn you, they fill up really fast. It's becoming really a popular thing. And photographers just love it because a lot of times we'll mow the leks. So because the sharptails like it better when it's more open like that, but also leads to a really good photographs too.
It's and how do you how would you apply to get in to see?
Yeah, I would check the Friends of Cracks website, Friends of Namekagon Barrens websites, and they're the ones that kind of administer the calendar for those reservations.
Oh man, so the habitat is open, right? I mean, what does it look like? It's a mixture, a little mixture, but it's open.
Yeah, the Pine Barrens is really a unique place. And in the world, one of the best places to see the Pine Barrens is actually northwest Wisconsin. And because of that, we take great responsibility for that and try to do a good job of managing it. It's a mixture of kind of the same prairie-type species you'll see in the central part of the U.S., you know, the big blue stem, stuff like that, the rough blazing star, things of that nature. Then you also kind of have this cool intermix of like what's called ericaceous shrubs, and that's really like blueberries and things like that. So a lot of blueberries up in the Pine Barrens, they like the fire as well. Then you also have kind of mixed in the oak, the jack pine, the aspen, some of these tree species that are also more of a pioneering nature of tree that kind of moves into these places as a fire or some other disturbance comes through and starts it all over again. So kind of this mix of what wants to be forest and what wants to be prairie and kind of all going on struggling together, and the wildlife can cash in on that. Really a great diversity. Some of our Pine Barrens properties, we do botany surveys out there and we'll find over 200 species of barrens plants on those growing just naturally. And as you go further north, we actually lose a few species, around 160 species, but that's also due to getting further away from the tension zone where the prairie typically was. So we lose some of those species, but still really diverse for not planting anything and just managing the land the way it had been managed for many, many years before us.
Yeah. Well, how was it created in the first place? Was it fires? You mentioned fire.
Yeah, fire is really important. These are deep, deep sandy soils. That dry out really a lot. They're very dry, not quite desert-like, but not quite what we typically think about in Wisconsin either. So they dry out a lot and very subject to burning. And fires happen very frequently in the Northwest Sands and in other parts of the state as well. But Native American burning was also, we know now, is a really important part of that. And those cultural burns, as we call them, were super important. And that's really what kept the Pine Barrens kind of more an open type system, and also other things too, lightning strikes, everything, holdover fires were all part of that fire, how that ecology framed was framed. And then the Pine Barrens is really a champion of the kind of the comeback. So you hit it hard and it comes back even better. Every time you seem to hit it with something like that, it just comes back even better. So it's a really neat system to work in and see it react.
Yeah, that's really cool. And they were, the barrens were once very widespread in Wisconsin, and now I think the habitat is actually considered globally threatened.
Yep.
And so is it people that led to the habitat loss?
Well, a lot of it was you know, other land uses going to, you know, farming and things like that. But other land uses too, like it was just kind of, we stopped the wildland fires from happening. And then the Pine Barrens naturally grew into more of a forested type system. And that's not all bad, because we know that the Barrens is still underneath all that. And if we can, sometimes we can open that land back up again, we know we're going to get a really nice response from the Barrens community. And then as we start prescribed burning, it just increases and increases and increases and multiplies the number of species we have out there. So it's a little bit more forested than it used to be. The Northwest Sands is about 1.2 million acres in size. And historically, it was thought to be about half to two-thirds open. And now we maybe have 50,000 acres of Pine Barrens, so of that more open-type Pine Barrens, I should say. So the math is pretty easy to see why the species that need that more openness, why they've been struggling.
Yeah. Mike in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon. My question is, we have the Wild Turkey Federation, which has brought back our turkey population to great numbers, and the Pheasants Forever, which has brought back our pheasant population to drastically awesome numbers. And how about grouse? I know there's some small organizations for grouse, but not much for sharp, nothing as far as I know for sharp-tailed grouse. And because I know my uncle used to raise grouse and turkeys and pheasants for the state in the 90s. But I don't hear too much about the grouse.
The sharp tail.
Yeah. And it's nothing but a sharp tail. Is there anything out there like that?
Yeah, the few translocations we've tried, what was it, 6-8 years ago now, we went out to Northwest Minnesota, worked with Minnesota DNR and grabbed a couple hundred sharp-tailed grouse and brought them back to a place called Muckwa Barrens because they were down to just a few birds there, and they had pretty good habitat. And we tried doing that release, and it was a slight increase over the time period, but not a big increase. So the few times we have tried it, and in other places they've tried it too, what we found is really the key is to having that habitat just perfect and lots of it. To the point now we're finding if we build nice habitat right adjacent to where the birds already are, within 3.1 miles is the number we use, the birds will naturally move there. And it seems like if they move there on their own, they're much more successful.
Ah, man, that makes sense. Thomas in Manitowoc has a question as well. Let's go there. Hi, Thomas.
Hello, I just got on the phone, so I don't know if you covered this, but up by Spread Eagle on the Barrens there, between Iron Mountain and Florence, there used to be sharptails there, and they've been actively burning it. I just wondered if they had a plan to reintroduce sharptail grouse up there. Oh, and one other thing, if anybody wants to see red-headed woodpeckers on the Spread Eagle Barrens. There's a lot of red-headed woodpeckers up there for the last few years.
Very cool. Comment, Robert?
Yeah, the Spread Eagle Barrens is a really nice barrens. They had sharptails years ago. It'd be great to see them there again. Currently, we're still trying to restore them to where we currently have them and trying to get them to move into more landscape, more of that Northwest Sands landscape. And as we do more new habitat projects, we are seeing them move on their own, which, like we kind of talked about already, it seems to be the more efficient way or the way the bird prefers to do it. And like I say, we dropped off a couple hundred birds at Muckwa, and it didn't work out so good. But we're hopeful that through this kind of natural restoration of the landscape, the birds keep moving on their own. And that seems to be the way the birds want to do it.
Yeah. Somebody else wondered, what do they eat?
They eat a little bit of everything. They live in a really, really diverse landscape, so they have a huge buffet laid out for them. They'll eat buds off of trees. They'll eat catkins, kind of the pre-flower part of the tree. They'll eat berries. They'll eat insects, everything out in the landscape, little greens, especially off of strawberry and stuff like that. They really have a very diverse diet, and definitely in that first month or so of life, insects are really, really important to the young broods.
Hmm. You worked, you've done a lot of work at Crex Meadows. What's the history of Crex Meadows?
Oh, that's a volume in itself. It started as a Crex carpet company, back in the 1930s and 40s. They actually made like woven rug type carpets there, almost like wicker type furniture too. And eventually with the advent of, modern carpets, the Crex Carpet Company kind of, and they got Crex actually from the name Carex, which is the scientific name for sedge. So it kind of was kind of neat how it moved into kind of the wildlife area becoming Crex Meadows, because eventually the land went tax delinquent. The state ended up with the land, and there's a lot of open marshes and some pine barrens. So it was a great spot to do waterfall management, great spot to do barrens management for sharptails. And the state has been managing there since, I think, 1950 something. So it's been a very long time.
Yeah, I think they wound up with 12,000 acres or something like that of tax delinquent land. And, and then I think they bought 5,700 acres or so.
Yeah, it has grown to one of the biggest wildlife areas in the state, and really a cool spot to visit, I would say, especially in the spring.
Oh, yeah. And the process that it took to convert Crex Meadows into a suitable sharp-tailed grouse habitat, that is an interesting story in and of itself.
Yeah, the sharptails were in that area forever, as far as we know. But then, as the tree started regrowing with the advent of taking fire away, we started to prescribe burning again, and the birds have been doing better and better as we've gone. And in more recent times, we saw the sharptail grouse population continue to decrease despite our efforts. We took a hard look at it, and we decided we needed to do a better job on our habitat management, and kind of came up with a few recommendations. We've been implementing that kind of focused down approach and prioritizing that, because it is a really important habitat, like you're saying. And within a few years of really focusing down on that approach and really knocking out thousands upon thousands of acres of prescribed burning and putting fire back on the landscape, the Firebird responded, and they're actually doing quite well now, especially at Crex Meadows.
Yeah, that was what I think it was the Northwest Sands Regional Master Plan or something like that that was followed from maybe, I forget when that happened, maybe 2019 or so.
Yep, and that, a lot of that was also based on the Northwest Sands Habitat Corridor Plan, which was from 2012. So it was all fairly recent, really, where we kind of really figured out what we needed to do. And that's one of the cool things about barrens management and sharptail management. A lot of times you're talking about kind of rare species, we don't really know what to do. But now we've really started really getting after the habitat work and see the birds respond. Now we know what to do, and it's all about the habitat. And we want to make sure we stay after that because it seems to really be impacting the sharptails in a positive way and many other species as well.
Yeah, I think it was about 2021 maybe when the population started to turn around. It's not that far long back.
No, and that's why stuff like this education outreach to us is really important, because in 2021, we think we hit the low of the lows. We hope we hit the low of the lows. We go out and count those dancing males in the spring, where we count most of the males we figure we use as the index to the population. But in 2021, we only counted 132 males dancing in the entire state.
Wow.
And now this last year, just at Crex Meadows, we counted 119. And 275 in other spots in the Northwest Sand. So it was a really nice turnaround, but has been fairly recent.
Yeah, it sure has. And I think last year for the first time, Wisconsin held a limited hunt for sharptails. How did the DNR come to that conclusion?
Yeah, that was something as we were looking at a bunch of the plans. We have a sharptail grouse management plan that was approved in 2024, and we have a sharptail grouse advisory committee made up of lots of different stakeholders, including some DNR biologists, but also from our partnerships in the federal forests and the county forests, Audubon, Rough Grouse Society, Sharptail Grouse Society, very important member, Wisconsin Conservation Congress, so lots of different memberships in that committee. And we were tasked with coming up with some metrics that would help us decide when we would want to have a season yet again, because the last season was in 2018. And then within the last like 2 years or so, we finally settled on some metrics. And then last year, the birds met all those metrics. And those metrics are, how many dancing males we have out there in the spring, what was the winters like for the bird? Was it good survivability conditions? What was the brood production like the year before? And even that spring, what a nesting success looked like it might be. And then we also look at what's the habitat conditions too? Do we have enough habitat and is it of a high enough quality?
And
look at all those metrics to make the decision.
And so there were some hunters. Was that a, I'm trying to think, was that a lottery kind of situation or what?
Well, yeah, there was an application. We ended up for the state hunters, we had 12 tags, and five of them again getting filled. So it was a very limited hunt.
Yeah, so, and we're talking a bag limit of one, correct? Or
right, one per tag, and there was only 12 tags available for state hunters.
Okay. Somebody might say, well, how would holding a hunt help the conservation effort?
Well, it has brought some attention to it for sure. and there was some fear that, we would never see this population come back again. And that was one of the things people really, really missed. Like they grew up hunting sharptail grouse, wherever it was, back behind the back 40 at home, or they'd come travel to someplace and hunt them. They really, really missed doing that. And we heard that from lots of different folks and hoping we could get that back again. So, and we were answering the question every year, should we have it again or not? And for a number of years, the answer is no, until the birds finally responded. So we do have more research ongoing to help us out with that decision. What science we have now is what we base those metrics on for making decisions today. But in shortly to come, we're going to have kind of what a minimum viable population is and some other things that might help us make those decisions and kind of hone those quota setting metrics to be even better.
Yeah, and they're a little bit bigger bird than the rough grouse. I've eaten rough grouse, but I've never eaten a sharptail grouse. Had that experience, but they're a good tasting bird, I'm told.
Yeah, they're not quite as of a white meat as rough grouse, or a little bit more of a pink, but it's a very flavorful
So what are your hopes for the future of sharp-tailed grouse in Wisconsin?
Well, I hope the first and foremost, and we know what the best things we can do is, you know, it's habitat. So continue to working on the habitat, both on our all the wildlife areas and our partnership lands where we have current projects. We also want to expand to have more projects to help connect the landscape. What we need to help connect the Northwest Sands landscape is more kind of projects between the bigger projects. We call it a stepping stone type corridor. So every within 3.1 miles, we need another habitat project of sizable enough to have species movement between those properties. And that's for a whole host of species, that's going to be helping out. I mean, monarchs come to mind, things like that, that especially ones that migrate and move. But hopefully on the habitat front, we can continue to reunite this Northwest Sands landscape for many species, including sharptails. And as we do that, we should help restore this population to even a higher number.
That's great. And what can community members do to help sharp-tailed grouse conservation?
Well, certain organizations like the Sharp-tailed Grouse Society have been pitching in. I talk to them, you know, several times a week as far as what can we do, how can we help. So this is a great organization to join and help out. They can come and view sharptails on the Lex and contribute to those friends groups, and also maybe be through seeing that dance, help us spread the word that it's important and unique to Wisconsin. A lot of people think of the North Woods as all woods, but it's not all woods. There's other things going on there as well. So just kind of help out with that, get that message across. There's some neat things going on kind of in your backyard that, you know, hopefully you can learn more about and also educate others. We have a lot of information on the DNR website on the Sharp-tailed Grouse Management page. That's where I kind of stuff everything there. But that's where our management plan is at, and kind of our friends group brochures are there as well.
It's great. And if you, I tell you, seeing that dance, you're never going to forget it. it's quite an experience to see. And I hope I know every year those blinds sell out kind of in pretty darn quickly. When can you apply, by the way?
They're open now. Open now. And I think some are already full.
I wouldn't doubt that a bit, Bob. Hey, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. I appreciate it. And I really appreciate all your years of work on this. It's got to feel good to know you've done some things to help the population. And we appreciate your efforts. Thank you, Bob.
And it's a great big partnership up here. So a lot of folks involved.
Bob Hansen, wildlife biologist at the Wisconsin DNR. Really, really interesting to talk with him. And hopefully we can get him back and down the road and keep track of how that population is doing. Up next, though, we're going to take a look at glyphosate or Roundup, some new information about that, and I hope you'll join in with your questions about Roundup. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Roundup is now considered the most heavily used agricultural chemical in history, but critics have raised concerns over the health impacts of the glyphosate chemical, and now a science journal retracted a study on Roundup safety, citing, in their words, serious ethical concern. Larry Mueller here going to try to make sense of this news, plus hear a little history about Monsanto and Roundup as well with our guest, Bart Elmore joins us now. Bart Elmore is a professor of environmental history and core faculty member of the Sustainability Institute at The Ohio State University. Bart's the author of the book Seed Money, Monsanto's Past and Our Food Future. He's written several other books as well. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What do you think about the chemical herbicides? Are you a farmer or a gardener maybe who's used Roundup? Or use it now? What do you think about concerns over its safety, and will you continue to use it? Well, questions do you have? Give a call, Number's 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Bart Elmore, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Larry. This is great.
Last month, the Journal of Regulatory Toxicology and Pharmacology formally retracted a scientific paper published in 2000 that had some key findings about Roundup and public health. The paper's titled Safety Evaluation and Risk Assessment of the Herbicide Roundup and Its Active Ingredient Glyphosate for Humans. That was back in 2000. And what did that paper conclude?
Well, it was a really key study that I think for Bayer, which actually bought Monsanto in 2018, has been used is to say, look, here's a study that shows glyphosate is safe. It's a study that holds out that there really aren't any harmful effects on humans. But just to give some context for this, you know, Roundup is an old herbicide. You know, it was produced in the 1970s, beginning in the 1970s by Monsanto, this chemical company from St. Louis. It became the first billion-dollar herbicide in history. I mean, it was the most profitable and very successful. And one of the reasons it became so popular was in 1996, when Monsanto was able to genetically engineer crops to be able to tolerate heavy spraying of glyphosate during the growing season. These were called Roundup Ready crops. So you could spray your crops, kill the weeds, but it wouldn't hurt the plants. And so Roundup use really exploded after 1996. The problem became in 2015 when the World Health Organization's cancer agency, IARC, issued a statement saying that glyphosate was a probable human carcinogen based on their meta-analysis of academic studies and journals. And that led to a bunch of litigation over the last several years in the late 20-teens. And this was one of those studies that could be held out, the Williams study from 2000 by Bayer, which had bought Monsanto in 28 to say, it's safe. But as you mentioned, it was recently retracted. And so that's created a lot of change.
that's a good preamble to this whole thing. Why was it retracted by the Journal of Regulatory Toxicology and Pharmacology?
Two really great scholars, in fact, someone I know very well, Naomi Oreskes, who is a professor of science and technology, history of science and technology at Harvard, and Sasha Alexander Kurov, who studies kind of science communication, did a deep meta-analysis of this Williams study to see how influential it was, both in public conversations, you could think of Wikipedia citations, and also in the academic journals. And it was cited hundreds of times. In fact, they saw it as one of the, I think it was like 0.1% of studies that had been cited to suggest the safety of glyphosate. But during those trials that emerged in the late 20-teens, after IARC had determined that it was a probable human carcinogen, plaintiffs around the country argued that cancers that they had, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, was linked to glyphosate exposure. And during those trials, a document was released. I was writing my book at the time that showed very clearly that Monsanto said they had essentially ghost written that Williams study. That is to say, they had it, you know, they had Monsanto employees that had been shaping that article. There was a conflict of interest there, obviously. They did not mention that conflict of interest. They didn't mention these authors who are related to Monsanto. And so with Naomi's work, which showed how influential this study was, coupled with that document that showed it had been ghostwritten, the journal ultimately decided to retract that very important study.
Yeah. And then as some of the evidence I was reading, I mean, there were emails that they were able to obtain that clearly showed this Monsanto's own writing of this.
Yeah, and, you know, look, Larry, for me, I spent over a decade studying this company, and I was able to get inside the corporate archives of the company. they gave me permission to go in to look at their records. And while I think a lot of the documents that came out of the trials were the most damning, that is to say during discovery, as documents were released, where they said these things, you know, they said them very directly. I mean, here's one in front of me right now. Quote, Ghost wrote cancer review paper, Grimm et al. Monsanto's Dr. David Saltmars, who in a summary report of his 2015 accomplishments. So this was the language I was seeing, you know, very clearly. In fact, there was another scientist, I'll give you another quote from inside the company. Monsanto had been talking to an ex-employee and consultant, and they were going to try and keep his name off of another glyphosate paper that he worked on. And he said this, he said, quote, I can't be part of a deceptive authorship on a presentation or publication. We call that ghostwriting. And it's unethical. So there is a paper trail here. I think that is what gives people a lot of concern, that suggests there was a lot of attempts to ghostwrite or influence the conversation about the safety of glyphosate. And that's, I think, what's leading to a lot of concerns about it today.
And a lot of trials as well.
A lot of trials. Yeah, I mean, when Monsanto was bought by Bayer, Bayer was worth $120 billion. That was essentially its market cap in 2018. Right after they bought them, they lost the first Roundup case. It's called the Dwayne Johnson case. It came out of California. A gardener who claimed his exposure to Roundup was linked to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. They won that case. Over the course of the next 6 months, Bayer's market cap went from $120 billion to about $60 billion. It was worth half in 6 months of what it had been worth before. And so these cases have become a real boogeyman for the company because they don't really know how to solve this. There was an attempt to settle it. Bayer set aside $10 billion to settle all these different cases, hundreds of cases around the country, but many people don't want to settle. So there are cases still ongoing, and Bayer has actually reached out to the Supreme Court to try and have it intervene to say, look, we shouldn't be sued for a chemical that the EPA approved us to use. And that, you know, the EPA had studied and said it was safe to use. So they're trying their best to get a Supreme Court intervention here to block the litigation going forward.
Oh, my gosh. What was the your reaction when you heard about the retraction?
Well, interestingly, historian, it's a pretty small world. So I knew Naomi. You know, interestingly, Naomi Oreskes is also the person who wrote a book called Merchants of Doubt. The same person who was able to show why this paper should be retracted wrote this book called Merchants of Doubt, where she had actually shown the playbook that the tobacco industry had used to sow doubt about smoking. She had also written the book in this book as well. It showed the ways in which the kind of climate change deniers were able to sow doubt about climate change, try and block action on climate change. So she's a legend. This is not her first rodeo. And so I really wasn't surprised. What I thought was remarkable was the depth of the analysis that she and her colleague went through. So they went to Wikipedia, for example. And I encourage people to go do this today. Go check out glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup. And the Wikipedia page, you can go up and look at all the edits, the history of who's changed what. And you'll see these moments where there were real attempts to edit the discussions about the Williams ghostwriting. You know, because there had been leaks as the trials moved. No, let's remove that. This is a reputable study. And so she just did an amazing job, I think, of tracing how even on a site like Wikipedia, which we all know is, you know, not a gold standard journal, but it influences how people think about, well, should I go buy this or not? How this was playing out in spaces like that. So I would encourage everyone to go check out Oreskes' article as well. It's a really great piece of historical work.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking I am an emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin, and if I, part of my work, I conducted research, and I can remember research of other professors who some of the money came from companies to prove or disprove something, and I can remember in one case. At least one that I'm familiar with, where the company was really mad because the professor was willing to do this correctly and learned and reported things that went totally against the company's interest. It's beyond my comprehension. If someone had come to me and said, let me write this research article for you, then we'll just put your name on it. I mean, it's beyond the pale for me to even think about agreeing to something like this.
Absolutely. And I should just give a shout out to the University of Wisconsin. I'm an environmental historian, and University of Wisconsin is one of the legendary centers for environmental history. So I would think that most of the historians there would have done the same thing. And you even see it in that example I gave you. People were approached, and we have documents from inside that say, no, I'm not going to do that. I think that's unethical. I'm at Ohio State. It happened here. And so, you know, we know that this money influences the decisions being made. So it's tough.
It is indeed. Our guest today is Bart Elmore, professor of environmental history and core faculty member of the Sustainability Institute of The Ohio State University, and author of Seed Money, Monsanto's Past and Our Food Future, and several other books as well. Questions for him as we talk about glyphosate and Roundup, give a call, the number 800-642-1234, or you could email us, and the email address talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about glyphosate or Roundup on the program today with our guest Bart Elmore, professor of environmental history at The Ohio State University. Lots of callers, lots of emails. Let's go to Michael in Burnhamwood next. Michael, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, yeah. I just have a comment and a couple questions. As a horticulturalist and a forester, I've been using Roundup for decades. And, you know, in my field, it's like the miracle elixir. You know, you kill the weeds and you can plant and you don't have that competition for the plants that you're putting in. So it, I just use it. I buy it and use it all the time. Gallons of it, you know, almost, you know, in a season. But anyway, I wanted to ask if you could tell me what is the chemical process that causes the plant's death? I think it's interference with some chemical processes, and how does it kill the whole plant, including down to the roots? And then is there any detrimental residue left from glyphosate in the soil, or does it break down? I've been telling people or believing that it breaks down into organic elements and it's harmless to the soil after it's used. Thank you.
Michael, thank you for calling. Bart, are you familiar with that process?
Yeah, it's a great question. And you know, one of the things I did here in Ohio is I'm obviously surrounded by a bunch of farmers. I worked on a cattle farm when I was in grad school, and so I think, you know, a lot of us had exposure to Roundup or have spent time with people. It is, you know, in 96, if you talk to anybody who's been in the game for a long time, they say it was like magic. You know, when you had Roundup ready crops, outside of what this person was talking about, which is just the effectiveness of Roundup as a broad spectrum herbicide, you know, for various things, whether you're a gardener or a horticulturalist, you know, but for farmers particularly, it really simplified things in the short term. You know, it was a pretty remarkable thing. You could spray your crops during the growing season. It was genetically modified so that the crops would survive, your weeds would die. But the mechanism is really important. And I'd actually, for this caller, I'd want them to think about this. I started out in biochemistry, which is what I love this stuff, because I think knowing the science matters. the way that glyphosate works is essentially it's the EPSP synthase inhibitor. Okay, now that's a wonky thing to say, but it's basically an enzyme inhibitor. And what it does is it binds to a particular enzyme that's found in plants. And this is very important. In the 1970s, one of the arguments about why glyphosate was so safe was that mammals and humans do not have this EPSP enzyme. So the thought was, you know, it'll affect and disrupt this enzyme's activity in plants, preventing them from producing amino acids that would allow them to grow. But it won't have these harmful effects on humans and other wildlife. The thing that I would want this caller to look into, and it's something that I'm writing about in my new book, I'm writing a microbial history of the world. So I'm focusing on the microbiome of the gut, but also thinking about microbiomes in the soil. And I think one of the interesting paths I've been following since that book came out is the fact that we know that this synthase EPSP enzyme exists in microflora, in our gut, and they exist in the microflora, that is to say the microbes that are in our soil. And if you do a broad search of the literature right now, you're gonna find Nature articles that have come out that suggest, and I wanna be very clear here because I'm a historian and I think it's so important to be very clear on the science. We do not know yet whether there are links between microbiome disruption and clear links between various health ailments people may be facing. And to be clear, it's possible that somebody's been using Roundup for a long time may not have any health effects. That's just the nature of how some of these exposures happen. But I think one area that this caller might want to look into, and others who are kind of interested in, well, what does the current science say about the safety of glyphosate, is this new area of microbiome research and the effects. Okay, so we don't have any EPS enzyme in our own human cells, but on the tip of my finger here, there may be more microbes than there are people in the United Kingdom. Sorry, I know you can't see me on the radio, but pointing to my finger, you know, it's remarkable. We have 100 trillion microorganisms in our gut. And I think this is a really something we should be paying attention to. If glyphosate, even in low, and this is your point, we do know that there are residual quantities of this stuff even found in Cheerios. Well, the question is that enough to have adverse health effects for people? These are questions that I know because I've been inside the labs in Cambridge and other places of scientists who are looking at this very closely. And I don't want to be alarmist to say, we know for certain it's going to cause this or that. But I do think it's an area that me as a parent and somebody who's also been around glyphosate myself, like the caller has, is really interested in looking more into. So,
and as an aside, can you let Clara know when your book is coming out? We'd love to have you back to talk about that, to talk about your new book, as that sounds really interesting. Let Clara Neipert, who you've been dealing with, know so that we can get you scheduled for that. You know, just to go along with to sort of an angle of what Michael in Burnhamwood was talking about, we got an email from Jeff in La Crosse. He's writing to get, he has a secondhand report on what he heard from his nephew, who is a farmer in Caledonia, Minnesota. Jeff's nephew said Roundup is no longer works for him. It actually has very low effectiveness and it's creating a lot of problems. His worst problem is wild marijuana. Roundup has no effect on it at all. He said in the past that reps from Monsanto have been in the area creating legal troubles for him and his farmer neighbors.
This is such an important thing, Larry. I feel like your callers are priming some, like, the most critical things I think I would want a public audience to know, which, by the way, thank you for allowing scholars like us to come on your show, because it's so important for us to connect to folks who are out there trying to think about these problems. So, yes, I mean, the biggest thing that I wrote about in my book, Seed Money, was exactly what this caller was experiencing. As early as 1999, we began to see weeds that were developing resistance to Roundup. And it's no surprise that when you put selection pressure on a species, I know that your callers are, you know, environmentally conscious, you know, those species are going to adapt. And that's what's remarkable. 96 was the introduction of Roundup Ready crops. Within 3 years, we started seeing, because of the amount of glyphosate being used, weeds were developing resistance to it. Now, you had mentioned, Monsanto, what if they came to Wisconsin, what you would have done? Well, this isn't a hypothetical. Here at Ohio State University, we have the top weed scientists in the country. And these aren't people that are either pro or anti-GMO. They're out there to help farmers however they can. And they were noticing in their greenhouses resistance for palm amaranth and other mare's tail and other different weeds very early on were developing resistance to Roundup. And they said, you need to go tell your farmers. Monsanto, this is a true story, showed up at my colleague Mark Lauchs's office here at Ohio State. He'd been here for decades. He said, I'm seeing the signature of resistance. You need to tell farmers that you should be spraying so much glyphosate. And the Monsanto rep told him, and this was in the book and quoted, he said, you're not seeing resistance, is what the Monsanto rep said to him. Now, Mark Lauchs said, graduate student, leave my lab. Closed the door, and he said, he quote, read the Riot Act to this Monsanto rep. And he said, look, you don't come into a public university and tell us, people who've been doing this for 20 years, we're not seeing resistance. It's happening. And so your caller, when I hear these stories of people like your caller, what they're trying to say is, it's a broken model. The kind of Roundup Ready, we're just going to spray this as much as we can, and create these resistance problems, because now farmers are having to go back to older chemicals to beat back those Roundup resistant weeds, dicamba, 2,4-D, and these are more toxic chemicals. So that's one of the bigger problems, is that we have a broken system with the Roundup Ready system.
Mike in Bayfield wondered if Monsanto has any legal or civil responsibility for the harm done by glyphosate and the tainted research on it.
That's what's happening right now. I think that's why this Monsanto case is so, these cases are so big. Again, you have a company that is worth less than it was to buy Monsanto in the first place. I think it bought it for about $60 billion. It's worth less than that now. I've been inside of Bayer. I've actually talked to the C-suite executive since the book came out. It was a very weird moment. I have to say, I wrote the book and I got an email from one of their senior vice presidents, said, we've read it. We'd actually like to talk to you. And I can tell you, I said, I'll talk to you, but I want to talk to you straight. You know, you've got a real issue here, both with the weed resistance issue and frankly, some of the other chemicals, that are part of their past as well. And I think they're really struggling to figure out how to solve these cases. That's why they're going to the Supreme Court. By the way, check your news, update your web today. The Supreme Court met on Friday in private to decide whether they're going to hear this case to block these Roundup litigation from going any further. The argument being EPA said it was okay, so they shouldn't be sued for it. Well, what if you now know that the studies on which the public perception of the safety of it were meddled with? Does that change the game? That's why this Williams retraction is so important. Last thing I'll say is, state legislatures, people should be aware of this, are being approached by Bayer to pass laws that would prevent Roundup litigation from being allowed in your state. Now, I don't know if that's happening currently in Wisconsin, but it's happening in Tennessee, North Carolina, Iowa, Florida, Missouri. My home state of Georgia has actually passed a law that essentially protects Bayer from litigation.
Wow.
This is how serious I think this issue has gotten for the company.
Boy, Bart, I wish we had more time to talk with you. Lots of callers online, but we are out of time. I want to thank you, and again, let us know about that book, and perhaps we can have you back to talk some more about glyphosate and Roundup and some of your work in that area. Bart Elmore, professor of environmental history, Cormac faculty member of the Sustainability Institute at The Ohio State University. His book, Seed Money, Monsanto's Past and Our Food Future. And he's got another one coming out we'll be talking with him about down the road. Thank you for joining us today, and thanks to our team, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and stay with us. Lots more in store on WPR.